You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thanks, everybody. The timing is particularly good, partly because it's Open Access Week, and partly because Michael's book came out last week. And he wouldn't flash it, so I'm going to flash it for you. I believe this is his first public talk since the book came out.
Yeah.
And the talk is about the topics of the book. Michael is a pioneering researcher in quantum computing, co-author of the most cited book on quantum computing, and a pioneer in open science, which is his topic today. Michael, take it away.
Okay, thank you. So Amar very kindly, well, he told me that this would be sort of a relatively small group and an informal discussion, so I thought I'd work without slides or without sort of a net today, and I'd like to encourage people to interrupt and make this into a proper discussion. I'm going to talk about open science, and this is, well, it's lovely to be here at the Berkman Center during Open Access, particularly as a guest of Peter. To talk about open science, and I want to start with a little story about open science, or an example of open science, just so I have something concrete to refer back to through the rest of the talk. So it's a story that begins with a mathematician at Cambridge University named Tim Gowers. So Gowers is one of the world's best-known mathematicians. He's a Fields medalist, which those of you who are into mathematics will know. That's kind of the Nobel Prize in that area. Gowers is also a blogger. This is not that uncommon amongst leading mathematicians. There are the 42 living Fields medalists. Four have started blogs, and kind of completing the picture, two of them have since abandoned their blogging. But there are still two very actively blogging. One of them is Gowers. In January of 2009, he decided to start a very interesting experiment in how mathematics is done. What he decided to do was to post a difficult, unsolved mathematical problem on his blog, a problem which he said he would, and I quote, love to solve, and work on this problem completely in the open, using his blog as a medium to post his ideas and his partial progress. And what's more, he issued an open invitation inviting anybody in the world who thought that they had an idea to contribute to post that idea in the comments section of the blog. So his idea was, or his hope was, that by combining the ideas of many people, it would be possible to make easy work of this hard mathematical problem. So this project, which he called the Polymath Project, got off to a very slow start. In the first 7 hours after he opened up his blog for comments, not a single person contributed. But then a mathematician named Joseph Solomosi from the University of British Columbia posted just a small suggestion. It was an idea, it was a simplification of the original problem, which he thought might yield some insight. 15 minutes after that, a high school teacher from Arizona named Jason Dyer posted a short comment. And 3 minutes after that, another mathematician, Terence Tao from UCLA, also a Fields medalist, posted a suggestion. So things were really kind of off and running at this point. Over the next 37 days, 27 different people would post really substantive mathematical comments. There were 800 comments in all, containing 170,000 words. So I wasn't one of these substantive participants, but I was following along very closely, actually, right from the start. And it was really astonishing to see how quickly ideas would be proposed, often in very half-baked kind of a form, and then would be very rapidly developed and improved by the other participants. So the reason I mentioned this 37 days period before is because actually after 37 days, Gowers posted to his blog to announce that the problem had most probably been solved. In fact, not just the original problem, but a slightly harder generalization. There were a whole bunch of details which still remained to be sorted out or actually checked. And they spent several months checking those and writing up the results for publication. But the core problem had been solved by this point. The Polymath Project had, had succeeded at this first problem. So since this happened, which was this was all in 2009, depending on how one counts, about a dozen or so similar follow-up projects have been done involving actually a much larger cast, not just mathematicians, but also other scientists around the world, with mixed success, I should say. Some of them have been really unqualified successes, like the first project, and some have been, I think, much... well, they haven't necessarily all solved the problems that they set out to solve. So this is, you know, it's a nice story of the use of online tools to do large-scale problem-solving. But what I want to talk about today, the key focus of my talk, is really why this isn't more common in science, or that's what's of most interest to me. Why is this an unusual story within science? And it's very similar to the problems which I know many people, certainly at Berkman, have worked on around open culture, open source, and things like this. But they have there are very different. Although the problems are similar, there are somewhat different fundamental causes and, I think, different solutions in the case of open science. So let me tell you about what is, I think, a very spectacular example of a significant failure of a promising idea. So this is an idea that was proposed in 2005 by a grad student at Caltech named John Stockton. It was for a website called The Quickie. This is spelled QWiki, and that standard for quantum wiki. And you can probably guess what the idea was. What he wanted to do was create sort of a research-level Wikipedia for quantum computing. His idea, or what he had in mind, was to build something like almost a super textbook for the field. It would be, you know, very rapidly evolving, kept up to date with news about all the, you know, latest developments in the field. But it could also potentially go well beyond that. If he was able to recruit enough researchers to contribute, it would also, you know, it could contain information about the big open problems in the field, people's speculation about how to attack those problems, and so on. So this was announced at a workshop at Caltech in August of 2005. It was very interesting to talk to people about what they thought about the idea. A reasonable fraction of the people present were opposed or hostile. Why would you ever want to build a site like this? Why would you want to contribute? A reasonable fraction of people essentially shrugged their shoulders, of the people I spoke to. But probably the largest group of people were quite enthusiastic. You'd talk to people about the idea and they'd say, wouldn't it be great if, you know, we could use this site to do the following? They have all kinds of ideas of their own. So you chat for a few minutes, or I had many conversations like this. And then you'd ask, so what are you planning to contribute? And people would, no. Yeah, I don't have time to participate. Yeah, I hope somebody else will do this, right? And, well, you can guess, of course, what the outcome is. If enough people are doing this, then the site is not going to take off. And, you know, I should say, by the way, it did not. The reason for the failure was not that the site was poorly executed. He'd worked very hard on it. He did a good job marketing it. He seeded it with lots of material. You know, if something like this was going to succeed, this was a good candidate. But, in fact, science is littered with examples of wikis like this. There's the String Theory Wiki, there's the Knot Atlas. There are many other examples of sites which, in many cases, are very well executed. They're very useful. Often they actually get a lot of hits, a lot of downloads, but they are not attracting regular contributors who are willing to build the site apart from the original person. I picked on science wikis, but actually you can repeat the same story in many other parts of science. Another sort of fashionable example over the last couple of years is the so-called scientific social networks, kind of the Facebook for scientists idea. So the idea being that you're going to, you know, these will be sites which will enable scientists to connect to other scientists with complementary interests so they can share data, share code, share ideas, which sounds like a good idea in principle. And there are now dozens of such sites, many with considerable funding, sites like Copernicus, ResearchGate, ResearchLink, and many others. And you go onto them and they've been very nicely executed, but they're typically ghost towns. They will say things like, we have 300,000 active members. You You create an account, you go online, and you can't find anybody else. And what seems to be going on, at least I know for sure in a few examples, what's happened is that the people creating the sites have gone to a scientific society, they've bought the membership database, and they've run a Perl script over the top of it or whatever, to auto-create accounts. These are not actual real people. They are indeed ghost towns. So what's going on here is kind of obvious, I think, for anybody who's lived in academia, but I'll spell it out. The fundamental problem, of course, is one of opportunity cost. It's the fact that if you're a young scientist, particularly trying to build your career, the way you build your reputation and build your career is through the publication of obviously scientific papers. And you might think that the quickie or a site like it is an absolutely brilliant idea, but you also understand the career calculus, which is, one really mediocre, crappy paper is going to do far more for your career than a long slew of brilliant contributions to a site like the quickie. And so it doesn't matter, even if you fervently believe that working on such a site is actually in science's collective best interest, that's a very hard decision to take. Now, you might come back and say, well, why is it then that sites or projects like the Polymath project are succeeding, right? Doesn't that kind of stuff up the story? Actually, I think it reinforces it. The Polymath project, it was very unconventional in some sense, but it was just using an unconventional means to a conventional end, right? They published two scientific papers as a result of this. There was a discussion in advance of the project starting about issues like authorship and who was going to be on a paper and these kinds of things. Unconventional means, conventional end. And of course, I think that things like the Polymath project are terrific, but there's nonetheless this conservatism. It means that sites like the quickie, which are merely ends in themselves, are not actually being exploited by scientists, or they're not being explored by scientists. And so what's needed is a change in the norms within scientific culture toward basically a scientific culture where at this judgment stage, when people are making hiring decisions, when they're making decisions about grants, people need to be recognized and rewarded when they contribute valuable scientific research, but in unconventional formats, right? So how do you go about achieving that kind of a change in the culture? And really underlying it, I'm talking about a change in the fundamental values. It's obviously difficult to do. It's difficult to get the several million scientists living in the world to all agree simultaneously to change how they make judgments about what's valuable. But I can give a couple of examples. How many people are familiar with the Bermuda Principles? Bermuda Principles? Nobody? Okay. Peter? Yes, okay. It's possible I learned about them from Peter. Wouldn't surprise me. So, very interesting story. Early 1990s, it was becoming apparent to molecular biologists, certainly anybody who was paying attention realized that it was only a matter of time before the human genome would be sequenced. And there's this very interesting question that then arises, which is what should be done with the data? Should this data be publicly shared? What should its status be? And if you think about it, there's a lot of similarities between the human genome data and a contribution to a site like the Quickie. If you're a young biologist in the early 1990s, there's not a whole lot of advantage to your career to be sharing that genome data widely with your competitors, right? You might think, in fact, everybody realized that it was in the community's collective best interest to be sharing the data widely, but that doesn't mean that you're necessarily unilaterally willing to go ahead yourself. And so there's a long story about what happened, and I'm going to kind of oversimplify it, but certainly a crucial moment occurred in 1996 when the Wellcome Trust organized a meeting in Bermuda. They invited many of the leading members of the Human Genome Project. Craig Venter, who would later go on to lead the private effort to sequence the genome, was present. Representatives from the Wellcome Trust, from the U.S. National Institutes of Health were there, and for several days they talked over this problem. And ultimately they agreed on this set of principles, now known as the Bermuda Principles, which stated that essentially, first of all, if you took any lengthy sequence of genetic data, more than 1,000 base pairs, that data needed to be released publicly to a database such as GenBank within 24 hours of being taken, and second, that the data would be put into the public domain. Now, this wasn't just people sitting around and kind of toothlessly agreeing on these principles. Actually, representatives from the funding agencies went back to those agencies, and within about a year or so, those principles were actually baked into policy, which meant that if you wanted to get money to work on doing this kind of sequencing, you needed to agree to abide by those principles. And ultimately, this agreement reached the highest levels. In April of 2000, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair released a joint statement praising, they don't praise them by name, but they're essentially praising the Bermuda Principles and urging that every country in the world adopt similar principles. So that's a nice story of how a mandate or a policy from a grant agency can cause a change, or can help cause a change, in the behavior of a large group of people, in this case scientists, towards a more open culture. And there have been several sequels to this, extending it to other types of genetic data. On its own, however, this kind of mandate approach, where grant agencies come in and mandate, thou shall share data, or thou shall share code, or whatever it is, they're certainly useful as enabling devices, and they can help change the culture, but they're not really enough. The reason why they're not really enough, let me pick the very concrete example of data. What you want from scientists is not merely grudging acceptance of such a policy. You need enthusiastic acceptance. You need people to internalize the value of sharing their data. And you don't get that just by applying kind of a stick in this way. The reason why you need that kind of enthusiastic acceptance, certainly in many areas of science, it is difficult to make sense of data. Right? You need all kinds of calibration data, all kinds of what was formerly tacit knowledge that was inside the laboratory, if you are actually to get any use from the data by people outside the laboratory. In cases like the Human Genome Project, actually an even better example is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, this astronomical survey. There's a robotic telescope in New Mexico which has taken millions of images of the night sky. They've released them as open data. But a big part of that project, huge part of that project, was establishing all the kind of calibration baselines which are necessary for the data to have meaning to anyone else, right? So, that's why this kind of enthusiastic acceptance is, or internalization of the value of data sharing is necessary. And that's why I think the mandates, while they're very, very helpful, or the policies, while they're very helpful, are not enough. So I was asked to speak for about 20 minutes. I'll close with a couple more examples. When talking about achieving this kind of cultural change towards a more open culture, certainly when I speak to scientists, they're often very pessimistic that such a change can occur. But there's a precedent for a very large change of this kind, and it's actually occurred in the very early days of modern science. You go back to the early 17th century. Just a little story involving Galileo in 1610. So it's July of 1610. Galileo has been using his astronomical telescopes for 7 months at this point. And for whatever reason, the very first time he'd used the telescope to point at Saturn, in July. And what he was expecting to see was what he'd seen when he looked at other planets, which was just a small disk. He didn't see that. He saw a small disk with two little knobs on either side. And what he was actually seeing was the first hint of the rings of Saturn. He couldn't actually resolve them quite himself. They had to wait for Christian Huygens some years later. Galileo you know, didn't announce this discovery to the world. He straight away he realized it was a momentous discovery. Instead, the first thing he did, almost the first thing he did, was he wrote four letters which he sent to four astronomer colleagues, including Kepler. What he'd done is he'd written down in his notes a description of the discovery, then he scrambled the letters into an anagram, which he sent to Kepler and his other astronomer colleagues. And this way, if Kepler, say, later made the same discovery, Galileo could reveal the anagram and claim the credit, but in the meantime, he hadn't revealed any information at all. Right? Pretty clever. Now imagine, you know, the human genome had been released that way. It could have been. Now, you know, it's tempting to say, oh, Galileo was a bad guy, but actually this was quite a common story at the time. Leonardo did this, Newton did this, Huygens did this, Robert Hooke of Hooke's Law fame. Hooke's Law was initially released as an anagram, right? That everybody learns in high school. So it was not uncommon. And of course, it was a natural response to the incentives of the time. Now, you know, scientists tend to say, oh, we solved that problem with the introduction of scientific journals. Well, that's kind of true as a first-order statement, but actually, you know, there's a many decades-long story associated to that. The editors of the first journals had a tremendous amount of trouble in convincing scientists to actually reveal the information there. The reason why was because at that stage in time, there was no link between publication and career, right? The link that now we take for granted as academics. But that had to be socially constructed over a period of many decades. There's this nice section. So Henry Oldenburg was the editor of the first genuine scientific journal, the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. And there's this nice story in his biography by Mary Bowers Hall. She talks about the kind of trouble that Oldenburg had in convincing people to share knowledge at all or to publish papers. And she talks about the way he would goad... He would identify two people, two scientists, who were working on essentially the same problem, and then he would write to them in turn, and he would kind of insinuate that, you know, scientist B was a little bit ahead of where they really were in order to get scientist A to disclose what they already knew of how to do that, and then bounce backwards and forwards, gradually getting more and more knowledge in this way. Right? He published distillations of this. In the journal. So this was not a simple process at all. Paul David at Stanford has written a very nice, he's written several very nice papers, but he's written an explanation of how we transitioned from, you know, the pre-scientific system to the modern system in which we take it for granted that, you know, free revealing of information is tied to a scientist's career progress. And he's written this explanation of how it occurred. And to sum up his 120-page paper in two words, I'm oversimplifying, but he basically says patron pressure or funder pressure. Right. So just to come back to the example of Galileo, prior to him doing his shenanigans with Saturn, he had made this great discovery of the four moons of Jupiter, the Galilean moons. Now, he announced that discovery almost immediately, and he did so for a very interesting reason, which was at the time, he was not entirely satisfied with his living conditions, so he made the discovery. He realized this would make him famous. It made him famous all over Europe. And he wrote to several potential patrons, including the Medici family, and said, he said to the Medici, I will name these moons after you if you agree to become my patrons. And they did. And so 6 weeks after he made the discovery, Galileo published this pamphlet at considerable personal expense, naming them the Medician moons on the front page. Unfortunately for the Medici, of course, we now call them the Galilean moons. But anyway, so there was this very interesting tension, right? The incentives for the funders were very different from for the discoverers. And the funders were able to use this. They had a lot of leverage. They had a lot more interest in this public revealing of the knowledge, and so they used that fact to cause this change. That's just an example of the kind of change that took place. So, sort of a nice story. It is, of course, very similar to what I described before with the case of the Bermuda principles and these mandates. There's obviously a close analogy. As I said, I don't think that's enough. I think more is needed. Just to close with a couple of, I think, interesting examples of very small steps which can be taken. There's a nice initiative, the Journal of Visualized Experiments. So the idea of this website is they will send a camera crew into your lab, if you're a practicing scientist, and get you to explain your experiment and show it visually. So any practicing experimentalist will tell you that, well, certainly in many labs, there's a lot of things which are very easy to explain in this way, which are difficult or virtually impossible to actually explain in a paper. And so this is a nice example where what was formerly tacit knowledge can actually be revealed to the world. And by creating this Journal of Visualized Experiments and enabling people to publish within that system, we're creating this interesting incentive for people to disclose information in new ways. A couple of other very sort of interesting and similar examples. There's a new journal called Geiger Science, which is coming from Springer, and the idea there is to take seriously the notion of publishing scientific data sets as first-class objects. So it's not so much, that you're publishing a paper that maybe has some supplementary material, a data set or an Excel spreadsheet. Rather, it's more that you're publishing a data set which might also have some supplementary material consisting of the explanation. That's kind of the balance there. Similar idea behind Open Research Computation, another journal. Its idea is to make code into a first-class object within science. Again, so that it can be cited, so that it can enter into this kind of citation, measurement, reward system within the scientific community, and so people can start to have an incentive for revealing the code which they use within their laboratories. One final example which I'll mention, I've recently started to notice that occasionally within Google Scholar, blog posts will show up. I think this is very interesting. It's certainly not happening systematically. Somebody I know who works on scientific blogging software has told me that it is actually possible to add tags to your blog, which will help it get spidered by the Google Scholar spider. I have not actually verified this yet. If it's true, it's very interesting. What it means is that if you write a superb research blog post, which gets cited by many other scholarly materials, it will start to show up in your citation statistics. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Sometimes it's not going to be a very good thing, but it will, however, start an interesting conversation amongst the people who rely on Google Scholar as a means for helping them evaluate scientists about what status exactly should they give to these blog posts. And I think that's exactly the type of conversation which needs to happen if scientists are to start adopting these new tools much more aggressively than they have. So at this point, having gone on a few minutes too long, I will stop and ask for questions.
Do you want to say anything about the use of these collaborative tools to take apart somebody else's research? The example I'm thinking of was when some scientists from NASA claimed that they had found arsenic-based DNA, and then another scientist said, posted a blog saying basically, this can't be correct, and sort of inviting everybody to take the thing apart. And I actually don't know how that got resolved, if at all.
Well, it hasn't been resolved yet, but it's still in process.
It was a very high-profile
Actually, let me give an example which has been resolved, which is very similar, which is one of the follow-up polymath projects. There was a researcher at Hewlett-Packard Labs, Vinay Dialelaka, who claimed to have resolved the P versus NP problem in computer science / mathematics. So one of the huge open problems in that area. And he sent a preprint to a few scientists who are prominent within the field, including Steve Cook, who's certainly a great computer scientist. And Cook made the remark that this seemed like a more serious attempt than many of the attempts which have been made. Somebody leaked this onto the web, this preprint, which I think is unfortunate. But once it leaked onto the web, people tore into it, and a blog run by a professor of computer science at Georgia Tech, Dick Lipton, sort of a polymath project actually started more or less spontaneously there, involving, in the end, more than 100 scientists from all over the world, who basically tore apart this 120-page paper, which incorporated ideas from logic, from physics, and from computer science, so many different things, and there were many different disciplines represented in the comments, basically deconstructing it, kind of taking it apart as much as possible to see, you know, were there... They knew they'd find mistakes. The question was, were they easily fixable mistakes, or was there something really fundamentally wrong with the approach?
Correct proof.
No, just that any 120-page paper is going to contain minor errors.
Right, yeah.
Right. That was no surprise.
Yeah.
The interesting question is, you know, are the ideas powerful enough to resolve the problem? And so, you know, was there any essential obstruction still remaining? And I think, you know, ultimately the consensus was within a week, right? This process took a week. That yes, there was an essential obstruction. They did manage to save sort of a small lemma, not a very major result at all, but there did seem to be some useful insight. But what was interesting was just to see, you know, how rapidly this process took place, and the fact that it was leveraging expertise in many different areas. You had statistical physicists chiming in to talk about the statistical physics parts of the paper. You had logicians, you know, chiming in to talk about the logic part, and so on, all kind of working together to establish, well, ultimately, that the paper probably doesn't work. And I think that's really the conventional wisdom at this point. DLLICA has still submitted the paper to for publication.
The thing, no really resolution happened.
I think it's still a slightly earlier situation there. Rosie Redfield, who's the, I guess, the main person sort of doing this online, she's, as far as I know, still working away at replicating some of the experiments.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I have a really... This is wonderful, by the way. It's hugely informative.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a very vague question in response to your really focused... It's possible to read science not only as something that, starting with the rise of journals, is something that gets published, but that it has thought of itself pretty much since then as a type of publishing. The work is done by individual authors. They work in private, general, not totally, of course. There's obviously teamwork and the rest of it, but you work in private in part because to a large part because you're guarding credit, as you say, and then you publish. And once you publish, the work is out there. It can be torn apart or promoted. And this is very much a publishing model, that the truths of science are conceived like things written down in books. If what's happening, as you're suggesting, might be happening, although maybe not as quickly as you'd like, if the medium is becoming the network, then one could expect that science maybe will start thinking of itself not as scientific knowledge, not as a form of having a characteristic of published knowledge, but of having a characteristic of knowledge on the net. Oh, good, because I don't know how to formulate a question, but it sounds like you're coming up with an answer, so that's...
I think this is absolutely fascinating. It's very clear, I think, what's going to happen, and you can start to see it in some of the really big collaborations. So if you look at something like the LHC collaboration or something like this, or actually, fun people to talk to are the people at Google to talk about their software ecology, I think is the right term that they have access to locally, which is, you know, what is it going to mean when we finally actually, when somebody publishes a paper and says, you know, the Higgs boson has been found at the LHC? Well, you know, no single person is going to understand the chain of evidence. In fact, they're not even going to come anywhere near close to it. They have 100,000 machines which they're using to process the data. And they've, you know, I don't know how many lines of code. I would bet hundreds of thousands or probably millions of lines of code, which has been accumulated over many years. And so you have this very interesting, I think it will be an example of truly networked, it's not so much network knowledge as using network knowledge to draw a conclusion where no single person has more than a tiny understanding of the chain of inferences that went into the final result. And so questions like, how do you just want to do peer review in this kind of situation, right? You know, peer review of that paper is going to mean, it'll mean something, but it's certainly not going to mean it's been checked, because none of the people involved in the collaboration could actually check it themselves. You know, they don't understand all the statistical analysis, they don't understand all the inference, they don't understand how the detectors work, the quantum field theory. I mean, there's just so many bits to it. So, yeah, the notion of, I don't know, your forthcoming book is about this notion of network knowledge, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't have the answer to this question.
No, neither do I. All I'm really saying, I guess, is enthusiastically that I think it's a very interesting question, and it raises really interesting questions, particularly about how does one validate this knowledge. Basically, any large-scale collaboration raises a really interesting question about validation, which is the methods which are used to validate are actually completely ad hoc. The IPCC is a very similar example. The International Panel on Climate Change, right? You've taken far more knowledge than any one person can actually hope to assimilate all the details of and combined it to come to some conclusion. And we're not using a recognized process. They're making up a process that one hopes is correct and believes is correct, but it's not necessarily kind of the standard model of making knowledge.
Examples of that in the history of science,
sure.
The classification of finite groups.
That's a really good example, yeah.
So that was a large project over 20, 30 years in which no one, series of papers, but no one really absorbed the whole piece because it was just too hard to do.
Well, there's this interesting sequel, right, which is after the proof was correct or had been accepted by the community, there's a 1,200-page appendix to the proof because a serious error was found, I think is it's a really interesting example of how mess-ups can occur. I mean, who knows what other errors were found? Right. Were not found.
Right.
In that. Yeah.
They're very, very interesting theme, and thank you very much for all the analysis. I'm kind of looking back at what you were started studying, the efforts in collaborative work mathematics,
yeah.
Which is quite a bit different than the collaboration in experimental sciences like biology,
sure.
Some part of physics, etc. And in that part, really the major part you would like people to have in order to make some progress is access to the data. Without them, sure. It's hopeless. For the theoretical work, however, the truth is that usually there might be 100 steps that you need to take in order to achieve something, but one of them could be the crucial. And the person who makes that, at least for those who have studied carefully, should get 99% of the credits. 98. because it is something that nobody had seen, even though they were looking at it for a long, long time. And that can also be exploited. So there are two examples from history of mathematics that come to mind. One was the fight between Newton and Leibniz that had tremendous results for both the European and the English mathematicians. British mathematics was left behind for 300 years because of these fights, and that's one thing. The second is a more recent one, the Perelman's approach to the Poincaré conjecture, which, you had an effort from somebody else to
Hamilton, yeah.
take advantage of it, even though to those who looked
cautious. Oh, right. Yeah.
So somebody with a lot of power in the discipline gave it a go to see if they can take it from themselves by pointing out that, here is not as good as it could be. So you have these kind of troubles in the theoretical parts. I think it makes much more sense to push this notion, which I think it's of great value, to the experimental rather than to the theoretical.
So, all right, I think there's several questions there. Your immediate question about what's the right way of divvying up the credit is it's an interesting one. I feel like it's a practical question more than a question of principle, which is to be solved by looking at specific cases. A very particular... I'll come to your example about Perelman, for example. So the story there, this great Russian mathematician, Grisha Perelman, resolved a very large open problem in mathematics, the Poincaré conjecture. And then after the fact, so he didn't really publish his proof. Instead, he released three preprints outlining a solution to the problem onto the Cornell preprint server. and never made any attempt at all to publish them or to get them refereed or anything like this. After that, several groups published sort of explanations of this proof, often much, much longer. I think one of them was about 400 pages, basically filling in all the missing gaps and so on and so forth. There were some accusations, right, that some of those people were trying to, you know, claim that they'd made a crucial contribution, right? This is the incident you're referring to. I think this is sort of interesting, but it's the normal bickering that's gone on forever in science. It's not really uniquely related. They were exploiting maybe the fact that preprints still have a somewhat uncertain status within the mathematical community, to basically, in some sense, there was less brand associated to them, and they were trying to exploit that fact a little bit. I think that's a transient problem. It's not a problem of principle. It's a very interesting one, and certainly this issue you raise of, how much credit should the person who originated the idea versus the people who filled in the details? That kind of question is a very interesting one, and people are going to need to develop. What I would like to see is people develop many different approaches to solving that problem, and gradually the community of scientists to converge on some sort of agreement about what the right way to make that judgment is. We'll never have perfect agreement. A nice thing, though, is that by working relatively transparently in the open, let's say something like the Polymath Project, you can actually go back and look to see what contributions somebody genuinely made and form your own judgment about those facts.
You mentioned before back there two things. One is validation. Uh-huh. The other is a methodology of validation. Because, for example, the data set that you choose in the data mining set, let's say something like cloud computing, or let's say algorithms to look at what we call big data. Mm-hmm. So IBM will have a different method. Intel have a different method. Google have a different method. Mm-hmm. So the question is, if you look at validation, we're talking about what's the most closest to the predicted value that is realistic, that is observable, is predicted in terms of this space. If you really look at the mathematical algorithm behind this, most of the time there's a lot of limitations. So if you look at different methods, right, you've got first the challenge of the data set you're looking at, right, the broad range of the data set, the sampling, and the method of sampling. You go back to the algorithm that was used to do the actual experiment, and you see that there's an underlying principle. The mathematical equation has different permutations, such as the confidence level, for example, two ways of expressing it with a natural log, we're using actually a ignore the natural log in the exponential. You can go straight to using the simple sampling. So if we look at, for example, standard deviation, and all, some of the,
I think you're getting caught in details. What's the
point about it is that there's a fundamental need for change in the actual statistical algorithms, all right, upon which many data mining methodologies are built upon, such as chi-square, etc., clustering, classification, so forth. So you got to go back to some of those concepts and look at the limitations, as well as look at the data set that was used, and then see if the method that you're using is actually accurate or not. That's really where we get into the concept.
Sure. I mean, there's this interesting explosion going on as more and more open data becomes available. People are doing more and more science in this way. There's this kind of shift to doing this data-driven science, and so there's this explosion going on, and as with all fields in their early days, there's lots of growing pains, right, as people disagree about what to do, what not to do. There's lots of interesting things there. Again, I feel a bit like this is actually a transient phenomenon in some sense. Best practices are still emerging, but there's a lot of statisticians, particularly on the case. The one thing, I guess the connection I would draw maybe to open science is that certainly something that will help significantly is a move towards more reproducible research and a move towards more open sharing of code. If you just look at something very simple, like, for example, a lot of analyses or simulations in science make use of some kind of Monte Carlo method, some kind of random number generator. Actually, a lot of random number generators are broken, right? They have systematic problems with them. And there's a large collection of literature which is known to be wrong because there's a problem in the underlying random number generator. What's that? Okay. And so, you know, certainly having the code in those cases, you know, in some open repository would be, well, I know a few people whose lives would have been significantly easier had it been the case.
That's why the RSA code was broken recently.
Do you want to?
Yeah. So with the Joe Ollicar P versus NP example, I mean, it was very interesting how people did spontaneously form into something like a polymath project, but it still seems that one of the striking examples is how it sort of caught the world's attention and it was almost a response to a crisis. And I think there was a sense among some researchers that, in some sense, some expert attention had even been squandered. I mean, everyone was there voluntarily, but unlike some of the polymath projects, people were sort of drafted in who might not have normally spent the time. And I think there was maybe a sense afterwards that, okay, that's good in response, you know, sprint in response to a crisis, but how could this sort of thing be done more sustained efforts?
Can it be done in a scalable kind of a way? Can you do post-hoc peer review like this in a scalable fashion? Is that, again, there's kind of a few different questions lurking in there. One you know, interesting observation is that there were some very senior computer scientists, Russell and Pagliazio comes to mind, who showed up in the comments section of this polymath project and said, look, you know, this is a waste of your time. It's obviously wrong. You should all go away. Mm. This is it's a strange attitude, in my opinion. It's not as though, I'll get to the arm twisting, but most of these people, including some very senior mathematicians and computer scientists, their arms were not being twisted. They were there voluntarily. If that's how they choose to allocate their time, good for them. Now, there were a few people who did get dragged into it involuntarily because, the classic case, I guess Lance Fortnow and Scott Aronson, two prominent computer scientists who are also bloggers, and they were just sort of getting email after email saying, what do you think of this proof? What do you think of this proof? And they'd say, they weren't terribly keen on it. They didn't really want to spend time on it. They didn't think it was likely to pan out. And yet they're constantly being badgered because they have this public presence. And that is an interesting phenomenon, which arose merely because the claim was so large. So I guess that's a genuine negative. And, it's a bit of a pity.
Asking if you have any thoughts about what other types of structures might be more amenable to sort of longer term sustained efforts, maybe even longer than polymath, but certainly more so than the sort of spurt of effort in that case. But, I mean, it seemed that part of what made it work so well was that it had such a high attention grab.
Sure. Some people are very keen on the idea that this kind of post hoc peer review should be done all the time. Personally, given that people are doing it voluntarily, I think naturally they're going to go for the most interesting claims. Everybody, every scientist knows that a 20-year-old paper which passed peer review but nobody's read since then because it's boring, is quite likely to be wrong. But the stuff which people have really relied on because it was groundbreaking has been checked multiple times since then. So in some sense, it's just speeding up that process which has always taken place. I don't think you're likely to see that kind of phenomenon occur across the scientific literature broadly ever, but I think it's likely to become increasingly common for very high-profile claims like that one. Really interesting fact about this, the first polymath project was done very self-consciously, right? It was, here's the process we're going to use, here's how we're going to do it, da-da-da-da-da. The Dielo-Lacar claim, the review of that, was not actually intended as a polymath project. Instead, Lipton was simply blogging about it, and this furious conversation started to take place in the comments, and they started to use the polymath wiki, which actually I set up and maintain, for discussion, and it sort of the structure emerged completely spontaneously, which is kind of interesting that it's obviously a very natural structure given the tools which are available, which is a large given.
The Bermuda principles, and of course the NIH requires open access on any work that's been funded through NIH, open access a year after publication. But you're not seeing that in other parts of science. And I wondered if you, that is, NSF doesn't have the same requirement for physics, mathematics, chemistry. And I'm wondering if you have any sense of why, if there's any reason sociologically that the behaviors of the communities are somewhat different.
Probably the best person in the world to answer that question is sitting beside me.
I do have an answer, but I don't want to take time from Michael.
So both of you are here and we don't get to hear.
Let's hear it.
The short answer is that there's a more urgent public need for medical research than for other kinds of scientific research. So there was a strong lobbying campaign for an open access policy at the NIH. There's a similar campaign for an open access policy at the NSF, but it's not quite as large a coalition, and the publishing lobby, which is resisting both, has been more successful in the case of the NSF. But there's Chapter 2 coming. President Obama, almost the day after he took office, not only launched a transparency initiative for data, but also offered to spread the NIH policy across federal agencies, which would include the NSF, EPA, and many others. And there's been a bill introduced in Congress twice. It's never come up for a vote that would have done this. Obama is apparently willing to do it by executive order if there's enough public support. He had a public comment period that showed overwhelming support, but it's been 2 years. There's been no Obama policy. There's about to be, or there could well be very soon, another public comment period. It looks like the White House and a bipartisan group in Congress are all in favor of this. It's a matter of time. And if there's a discrepancy in the timetable for adopting this policy, it's really due to the urgency of medical knowledge.
Can I ask a question? Who is arguing against it? Like, what are the logical arguments against it?
Publishers of scientific journals, which is a $12 billion a year industry.
You said, what are their arguments?
This will deprive them of revenue.
Including
it's a money argument.
It's the scientific societies who often function through those.
Some societies join the campaign, but it's the large commercial publishers which pay for the lobbying.
It should be said, so somewhere like, say, the UK, the research councils there now have open access policies.
And they're more unified than the similar agencies in this country. So they could act together, and the non-medical agencies could act along with the medical agency. Whereas in this country, they're much more independent.
If you look at the trajectory over 10 years, though, there's no doubt where we're going.
There is no doubt where we're going. Actually, that leads to a question of mine, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I'm interested in what you call enthusiasm. And I want to see researchers enthusiastically make their work freely available, not simply comply with a well-crafted policy. On the one hand, I see the community evolving in that direction. So if we just wait, we'll get it. Or if we wait longer, we'll get more of it. On the other hand, you talked about the social construction of the link between publication and career. And I'm wondering if we need more social construction of a link between openness and career. And if so, what construction do we need?
Well, okay. So that's obviously a very large question. If you're restricting simply to the case of say, publishing in gold open access journals, let's say that's what you choose to pick. It's really interesting what's going on at the moment, this public discussion which is taking place around the value of publishing in gold OA versus publishing in, whatever Elsevier. I think fundamentally it comes down to a question of values.
What is gold OA?
Yeah. Oh, excuse me, sorry. By gold OA, I mean gold open access, meaning publishing in journals mm-hmm. which are open access as opposed to, mm-hmm. say, institutional repositories or something like that. Mm-hmm. So Biomed Central or Public Library of Science or one of these... there are many such publishers now. And so one might say, one might ask the question, or I'm, a special case of Peter's question is to say, can you create a culture within science that actually views publishing in these gold OA journals as, better than publishing in Cell or Neuron or whatever? And I guess my answer to that question would be to say that the right way to attack that problem is actually to make it a public issue, right? Don't try and you can do this within the scientific community, but you can also actually start to make it embarrassing for scientists personally. You know when their family and when their friends are asking them whether or not their papers are openly available, that starts to be, I think that's certainly an example of what one can do. If you have, sort of an Al Gore type figure, well, actually, to some extent, I mean, you've had this role of trying to make it much more of a public issue. The the Aaron Schwartz case, which I guess probably many people are people familiar with this incident.
JSTOR thing?
Yeah, the JSTOR incident. So whatever you might think of the merits of the case, one thing that's happened is certainly that it's sparked some public discussion of what role the academic publishers play. So people, there have been certainly articles in many major news sources that have talked about whether or not it's ethical for an organization like Elsevier to be making 30% profit on revenue. Which is pretty good business model. It's not a very satisfactory answer.
Well, you're right about the incentives. If people's friends scorned researchers who didn't make their profit, that would change behavior pretty quickly. But my question is really about the social engineering that would get us there. One form of social engineering would be to tinker with promotion and tenure committees. And as you pointed out, journals that are making the release of code or data into primary publications give citation credit, basically, to scholars who do that, and that can be used in promotion and tenure. However, my experience has been, whenever you raise the idea of tweaking the criteria for promotion and tenure, you encounter this tsunami of academic conservatism. Even if you make very clear, and even if it's clear that you're right, that you are not affecting standards, you're saying, we're going to evaluate your work under the usual standards of quality. We simply want to make sure it's open. And if it's open and good, we'll reward you. If it's open and not good, we'll take a few points off. I'm sorry, if it's good but not open, we'll take a few points off. But we'll still look for quality in the same old way. But that doesn't get anywhere, or it's not getting anywhere fast. And I wondered if there's any social engineering we could do to change the reward system without simply waiting for it to evolve into some new form.
Yeah, I mean, plenty of ideas occur. Most of them unrealistic, but at least they may be useful. Mm-hmm. There was this proposal a few years ago in the research assessment exercise in the UK that it was going to be done purely algorithmically. Basically, they were just going to look at, they're going to take the database of citations, they're going to produce a number for each department. Now, this is a terrible idea for a whole number of reasons, but let's just run with it. Imagine that it had happened. It was ultimately, I should say, it was rejected as an idea, as you know. If it had been done, and things approximating this certainly are done, but if that had been done, then actually, simple tweaks to the algorithm would be exactly examples of this kind of engineering. You get a 10% premium if you're in a Gold OA journal, or you get a 10% premium if you've also made it available in an institutional repository, things like that. And that's the kind of thing where actually it's not completely unrealistic to imagine it happening, in the sense that you only need to convince a relatively small number of people to do that.
In fact, one of the Richards Assessment proposals in the UK was not to give credit for making your work open access, but to make your work eligible for being crunched or harvested by the assessment process. It had to be in an open access repository. That was a great first step. We're not giving you special credit for it being open, but we won't know it's there unless it's open, and then we'll pay attention to it.
Yeah, it's a nice example. Yeah.
One of the funders,
you said that's the principle that worked all the way. It's still, that's the main driver behind.
Certainly, I mean, that's a case where you get spectacular, sudden successes. Mm-hmm. And they can do some things. Simply a statement from, a statement from the NSF that they encourage researchers to submit non-traditional evidence of impact. So, you know, YouTube videos that they've uploaded showing lab procedures or whatever, could certainly go, a considerable way towards legitimizing it. At least it would get an interesting discussion started, as their requirement for a data sharing plan, which came in very recently, has got an interesting discussion started. I mean, none of these are particularly. It's all small steps.
If you distinguish enthusiasm from compliance with the policy, we're still talking about compliance. Mm-hmm. We can get funders to write better and better policies, mm-hmm. but all we're getting is compliance. Now, over time, we can show that compliance doesn't make the sky fall, and that can germinate some enthusiasm, especially if there are other enthusiastic people spreading the enthusiasm. But I was interested in how we could short-circuit the process.
Well, I mean, the only answer I can give that's, I think, really good is build tools which actually measure non-standard research contributions. Yeah. A very concrete example where this has been done is, I think, part of the reason why preprint culture has taken off in physics. So physics has this wonderful site, the Cornell Archive. If you're a physicist and you've just written a paper, as you're submitting it to a journal, you will also upload it to this site where it will become available the next day for free download by anybody in the world. More than half of all physics papers appear there first. If you're a physicist in most fields, certainly in my field of quantum computing, you wake up in the morning, you go and check the archive. That's the first thing you do. It's very widely used. Almost 100% of papers in quantum computing appear there first. One thing which has helped, which has really helped the preprint archive take off, was the fact that in the early 1990s, a very interesting decision was made by a service called SPIRES at Stanford. SPIRES is a citation tracking service, a bit like Google Scholar, but it's for high-energy physics in particular. And they made the decision that they would actually track, they would essentially combine the preprint and the published version of an article and track citations between that combined entity. I've sat in hiring meetings where everybody has their laptops out looking at the SPIRES citation record of some researcher. If you see that somebody has a recent preprint that's been cited by Ed Witten and Gerard Tuft and whatnot, this really carries a big impact. And I think that that's part of the reason, it's only a small part of the reason, but certainly part of the reason why preprint culture has taken off in physics. And that was a unilateral decision made by the people at SPIRES, that they were going to build a tool that would actually measure this non-traditional impact. And because it's there, people use it. And then, there's, I guess, plenty of initiatives now for people, people who are trying to create new metrics.
I was going to say, the more papers become open, the more data we have about their use. We don't have that data for closed papers. And so we have more metrics of actual impact, not just the crude simplifications of impact called citations. And so we have a dozen impact metrics now. And not only are they growing in sophistication, but they're growing in number, or they're competing with each other for accuracy and for uptake by promotion and tenure committees. And as they gain prominence or prestige, then there's an incentive for journals and researchers to get their works measured by these new metrics. So this is another one of these evolutions. The more open we are, the more metrics we'll have for real impact, the less we'll have to rely on surrogates.
And I see people doing things like, they will track using Mendeley the number of downloads their SlideShare presentation has and things like this, and they'll brag about it, right? So that's a very small example of reputation building, but it's nonetheless, it's significant. It's just that, once you measure something, people will start to talk about the measurement.
Ideas from the internet here. Mm-hmm. So I think that the whole idea is if we can get broader impact of society. Like I'm on the panel at NSF, and the problem is to get a broader impact of society. The publishers want to make sure that they own the articles. Like all my articles are owned by IEEE, but I can say go to ACM or go to SciSeer and get another version,
sure.
You know, which is much more succinct, 4-page versus 15-page.
Sure.
So I think collaboration makes your methodology more, and also the impact much more visible. And that's where you're going to get publishers to work together with us.
Yeah.
So I apologize if this has already been addressed, but changing the culture of academia and changing government policy sound like fantastic ideas in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose you want to accelerate progress on a specific scientific question, you know, by an order of magnitude in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if you've looked across alternative models. I mean, well-funded research institutes or industrial research labs or these large corporations. I mean, you mentioned Google, which is moving very fast. Are these other models more attractive in the short term for driving a particular question forward?
This is really an audience that asks very small questions. yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah, it's almost, it's too large a question to try and give a short answer to.
I put up with a long one.
Let me try and focus the question. Let me make one, I think just one comment. So we talked a little bit about, you know, alternate measures of impact. And so any measure, any tool which becomes widely used for measuring impact is an interesting example of an institution, right? It's an institution which starts to impact how science is done. Good example is the so-called H-index, which has been so widely, you know, promoted over the last few years, and the fact that, you know, things like Google Scholar and ISI Web of Knowledge will now automatically compute H-indices. So this is an item of data that is now widely used. The one remark I will make is that I am not a big fan of just I would like to see a proliferation of different measures for a very particular reason, which is that as soon as you have one measure which is very, very specific and is very, very widely used, you actually start to get, you know, it reduces cognitive diversity. Everybody starts to concentrate on it, on maximizing that one measure. And I don't think that's good for science. So I would certainly like to see a large number of different measures proliferate. That's I'm addressing a tiny, tiny fraction of your question, I'm afraid. But yeah, that's as good as I can do. Yeah.
Thanks, and I agree totally about that. Essentially, one of the reasons that Google has gotten in trouble is that because PageRank, everybody knows it's a good thing to go, and everybody's going after that. My question has to do with something else, however. There is another example of high collaboration, it occurs to me, which happened before the web was so available and prolific. I have Erdos in mind.
Yeah, sure.
Erdos was the person that really was the moving collaborator. He would go from place to place, would find people, and could essentially enthusiastically force collaboration. Everybody who would get involved with that would know that would get some high-level publication because he was also the big reviewer.
Yeah.
So what if we try to duplicate that model in which we, you know, create little Erdoses?
Well, supposedly he worked 18 hours a day, 365 days a year, on high on amphetamines. And, you know, I mean, that's quite a model. I'm not sure I want to duplicate it. It requires a certain mindset. Interesting fact is that almost all those collaborations were very small. Yeah, typically just 2, 3, 4 authors. He had 530 or something collaborators. But
he had several at the same time. So you know, he's going to usually hear the next 35, 40 papers that I would love to write. Anybody interested?
Yeah, it does restrict. I mean, actually, an interesting thing. So a big difference between something like the Polymath Project and something like, say, a large particle physics collaboration, is that the particle physics collaboration is designed, which means that the expertise which comes in has been fixed in advance, right? Whereas if you have an open collaboration, the expertise which comes in is not fixed in advance. And the reason why that matters, or that, why the distinction matters between those two things, is because in a collaboration, you know, which has been designed in that way, you only put in the expertise that you think you need to solve the problem. And that's great, but you're sort of taking a lot for granted. I'm thinking of an example like, say, for example, Einstein's discovery of the general theory of relativity. When he when he realized that he needed to develop a new theory of gravity, the furthest thing on his mind was that this would involve explorations of non-standard types of geometry. What has gravity got to do with geometry? Nothing. It was a fortuitous coincidence that partway through this, he talked to his friend Grossman, who was actually an expert on these other types of geometry, and he said, oh, you need to learn about Riemannian geometry. So this was an example of something which, in a designed collaboration, you would not have anticipated. Basically, you know, very often the biggest scientific breakthroughs, of course, when you realize a connection to something that you did not anticipate. And so I think that's a big advantage of open collaborations, that they can potentially take advantage of that as opposed to a designed collaboration.
Let me interject. We have time for one more question. We have to leave the room in 3 minutes.
Okay.
Hopefully this one will be quick. You mentioned a couple of human barriers to doing open science, and one of them being career path, the other one being an internal motivation to do so. But I think about the P versus NP project, yeah. And you have to have quite a bit, at least at this point, of ego strength to put your you know, really kind of out there paper out there and let everyone pick it apart. Can you say a little bit more about that part of it? For the scientist's part, that person who, you know, is seeing over this week just hundreds of comments tearing their paper apart.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was very unfortunate in that case. It was not what he wanted, and sure. I think it's a little bit tragic, actually, because it's damaged his reputation. You know, as a general, I once asked a friend of mine, who's quite a well-known blogger, how he managed to consistently write such interesting and edgy blog posts. And he wrote back and he said that it's actually because there are some blog posts he genuinely regrets writing. Mm-hmm. He said that, in his opinion, it would not be possible to write the really interesting stuff without also sometimes going too far. Mm-hmm. And that's a particular personality type that is capable of doing that. I guess that's where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly common when you talk to people who do open source software development as well. They say the same thing, that it's scary, you know, to take your code, which you've been working on privately,